listening to Berkeley Liberation Radio here at 104.1 on your dial, on your FM dial, and you can tune in or tell your friends to tune in to Berkeley Liberation Radio, to this program, which is Slave Revolt Radio, every Sunday, 12 to 2, live stream on the internet.
All right, good morning, everyone. We're going to kick off today with some news items, some updates on some events that we've been covering. And so I'm going to begin by talking about Proposition Q. Who's heard of Proposition Q? Proposition Rinaldi has. Rinaldi's been doing some work getting the word out on this proposition. Proposition Q is... the latest in a string of moves on the part of city officials and the police to criminalize homelessness and people's tactics for self-determination and preservation in the class war battlefield that is San Francisco. So Proposition Q, what it does is it empowers the city to evict tent encampments by giving folks 24 hours notice, and it says that with 24 hours notice and either a shelter bed for one night or a bus ticket out of town, police can come in and evict anyone from any tent throughout the city. San Francisco.
And I've been running around this whole past week talking to people, both homeless and not homeless, about Proposition Q. So they want to force these tents off the streets within 24-hour notice, which is wrong, because the city has too many homeless people, and there's not enough shelters. On top of it, I think the homeless should be allowed to set up tents. They're not even setting up in the nice areas. They're setting up in rural, industrial areas under the bridges. The spots no one notices. Pass the word on. Vote no on Q. The homeless should have a right to set their tents to exist. And for the record, if this proposition passes, it's just going to make it worse. It's gonna result in a really negative impact. Like they're right now, what they're doing is criminalizing all the tenters and all the squatters under the bridges. They're saying that dangerous spots. It's not dangerous. They clean up after themselves. Here in Oakland, you guys have a silent agreement. Certain neighborhoods with the city, they're allowing the homeless with tents to stay up as long as they clean up after themselves. In certain areas of Oakland, this silent agreement has even been issued by certain communities, and they've even set up ecology pickups to pick up their trash. As long as they're separating their trash, they're allowed to stay there. And I think that's a good example for our city. I live in SF, so right now SF is going through a lot of stupid stuff, and I think all these rich real estate agencies who are supporting Proposition Q just want a perfect city, and their position is perfection.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rinaldi. So we know who's benefiting from this and who's funding this, right? Yeah. These, the CEO of Yahoo is a financial backer, Ron Conway, hedge fund investors, place something called the Tech Angel Investor, William Oberndorf. These are the sort of moneyed interest in San Francisco, who sort of are benefiting from invisibilizing the wealth gap and criminalizing people's existence.
Yep, and it sucks. Every couple of years, not every election, but every other election, somebody creates a bill hating on the homeless. And it's why? Just to please people. It's just a marketing way. It's for them to just kind of make people think that they care about what's going on. That's all they're doing it for.
Yeah, that's a good point.
There's no solutions right now.
Mm-hmm. And the rhetoric around this bill has to do with tents, right? Or it's like homes, not tents, right? But there's no housing development or no plan for finding these people long-term solutions, right?
I just wanted to add that indeed what Rinaldi's saying is so true. They do not have a genuine solution for homelessness. It is a problem generated by a decaying capitalist system. And in fact, that system it is the cause of homelessness. They have no answer for it.
So, any more to add, Rinaldi?
If you work in San Francisco and you see someone homeless, or you see, tell them, remind them to vote. Remind everyone to vote no on Q. It's something that's going to affect the whole Bay Area if it passes. And it's definitely going to end up affecting Oakland if it passes. And Oakland has a good thing right now with the tent makers. So it's, let's stop, you know, and think about where people are going to sleep during the rainy season. And like, you know, let's just let them have their tents. Just remind them to clean up with themselves. I think it's a good solution.
Yeah, perfect. All right. We have to talk about the protest.
So this past week, I rallied with a bunch of Ethiopian protesters, natives, concerned about Ethiopia. Right now, Ethiopia is in a state of emergency. I don't know if you guys have read about this at all. But all civil rights have been completely postponed in Ethiopia. And since last November, there's been 500 and plus murdered. Over 1,000 people missing. And hundreds of peaceful protesters attacked and injured. I have a little bit of an article of what's happening in Ethiopia and how we can protect human rights. Ethiopia has issued a 6-month state of emergency in the country following months of citizen protest. The state of emergency comes in an environment of increasing repression. Government forces have killed more than 500 people since November of 2015. And authorities have already shut down access to social media in the Oromia region for 4 times this year. In other words, the government is really suppressing the truth. Internet shutdowns do not restore order. They tamper journalism, obscure the truth of what is happening on the ground, and stop people from getting the information they need to keep safe. So, right now, the whole state of the country is in complete a state of emergency. Companies and products or services of Ethiopia have desisted from selling and opening. It's all about the farmers. Like, the country is trying to force a lot of people off their lands. In the UN statement last week, Special Rapporteur Mayina Kayel and Dr. Agnes Alarm said, "We are outraged at the alarming allegations of mass killing, thousands of injuries, tens and thousands of arrests, and hundreds of enforced disappearances. We are also extremely concerned by numerous reports that those arrests had faced torture and ill treatment in military detention centers." So, all this has been developing. There's actually 2 huge conferences happening in the next couple of weeks. One here in the U.S., and they're going to talk about, you know, how to fix this. because one of the things that, during last week's protest that was mentioned was that the U.S. has done nothing to help stop this. If anything, they've just, have been, giving Ethiopia, false hopes. And I understand that the whole country is in a state of emergency and anarchy. Like, the president, he doesn't care. He's just, telling the police and the military to go and arrest anyone who's, against them. It's something that, we should take notice in. And, again, it's, like a lot of innocent people are disappearing. A lot of farmers being killed. A lot of journalists are being injured. And, I'm sure you'll probably hear more about this later on. But I thought it'd be kind of cool to talk about it. let's stop issuing military action against, the poor. Let's stop doing that.
All right. So now we're going to have Gerald tell us a little bit about his analysis of the workers' struggle, or a particular facet of the workers' struggle. Gerald?
Yeah. Yes. What I wanted to talk about, what I'm going to talk about, is something that we don't think of very often. I once worked as a longshoreman, and what I learned in my experience was that the longshoremen as a group held a lot of power on the waterfront because they stuck together and because they refused to work dangerously. And that impressed me. What I came to learn is that was a form of what's called workers' control of production. And, for longshoremen, or let's say miners, construction workers, that can be a matter of life or death. So what they recently did was they had a study, and I think that this is very interesting, because this new study confirms our worst fears about work. And that fear is, if you have no control over it, it can kill you. This was an article that was in the Guardian, and here is basically a summary of it. We all know how exhausting a stressful day at work can be, but now this new study that I'm talking about confirms the less control you feel you have at your job, the more likely you are to drop dead. Studying over 2,000 Wisconsin residents over the course of 7 years, researchers found that, and I'm going to quote this, those in high-stress jobs with little control over their workflow die younger or are less healthy than those who have more flexibility and discretion in their jobs and are able to set their own goals as a part of their employment. The study also found those with little control over their work timeline on a day-to-day basis are 15.4% more likely to die than those who are given the opportunity to craft their own daytime schedule. People who are unable to choose when to take a break or grab a cup of coffee actually live longer than their more regimented peers. Another recommendation of the study is for companies to engage in and encourage what they call, quote, job crafting, unquote. A process whereby employees help craft a meaningful and productive job for themselves where they can set goals. This news seems to suggest that a more hands-off approach to managing employees not only helps foster goodwill, but actually provides health benefits, no matter the person's industry or position. The takeaway, that companies are better off ensuring their employees have a proper work-life balance, falls in line with the current conventional wisdom that companies with pro-employee policies function more effectively and efficiently. Still, considering the May study revealed that Americans work more than anyone in the industrial world, it seems American employees may want to consider giving their employees the flexibility to control their workflow. Otherwise, it could be the worst case scenario. So what this really is about, from my perspective, now I'm just trying to politicize this study, because it's a study to just see people get heart attack, stroke, at work. Stroke, stress, kills. It makes you less healthy. And most people don't even know what's happening to them. That's the tragedy here. But this phenomenon is really called workers' control of production. And where you have workers that are real tight, respect each other, respect themselves, work together, defend their interests against the employers, you find that workers' control, that issue comes up more. Let's take something obvious. Let's say we're working in a mine. And this has happened many, many times. All of a sudden, if you sniff and you start smelling methane, what do you think you might want to do? Everybody out. Because of numerous explosions in the mines killing countless miners, through the years, the miners actually had an effective safety committee at every job site. Now that, you know, that makes sense. Miners, that's easy. You know, because that's a very dangerous job, construction workers. But this study points out that it's true for all workers, regardless of industry. I thought that was something that needed to be brought to your attention. Okay. Also, we have a situation here in Berkeley that I want you to be very much aware of. This person, Ms. Farlaka, deserves your support. So let me just set the context. There was a demonstration June 26 in Sacramento. The Nazis were planning, that's right, the Nazis. They call themselves the Traditionalist Workers' Party, and they planned a rally in Sacramento. So sure enough, they had this rally. Well, 500 people from around the state of California, predominantly young people, showed up to air their disapproving of this rally and to stop the Nazis from celebrating genocide, because that's what it was. They stopped these people from even having a rally at all. They smashed the fascist rally. And to my mind, that was a good thing. Unfortunately, there were some casualties for our side. At least 5 people were stabbed by these Nazis in the melee. Excuse me? No one died, but it's a casualty when someone gets physically injured. So, you know, we had to pay a price here. One young man came close that was stabbed 5 times. Oh, Senti, excuse me, could you share his name? Brother Vincent. You don't know his last name? Brother Vincent, a young black man, was stabbed 5 times. 5 times. And he was in the hospital for a spell. I'm proud to say that the young people looked after him. They visited him. They took him to their homes after he was released from the hospital. And he's fine right now. So, Miss Farlaka, her name is Yvette Farlaka, she was at this rally. And there is a video, which, you know, there's always going to be videos. And this video showed she got struck, but she was fighting back. She was a little thing. She was swinging and carrying on. It was a melee. She had to be, she got some medical attention right on the spot. The Nazis wrote the school board, threatening that her students would be harmed. As a result, they put her really on suspension, okay? And we want her back in her classroom. Yvette Furlaka, a dedicated middle school teacher in Berkeley and longtime civil rights and trade union activist, is under attack from the Berkeley Unified School District administration for her accomplishments as a progressive teacher and for her political activity. Ms. Furlaka has taught English as a second language and humanities at Martin Luther King Middle School in Berkeley for 10 years. She has constantly received strong teaching evaluations and support from her students, co-workers, and parents. And this I have to tell you, I went to the school board meetings, two of them, to support her. And I'm not a real emotional type of dude. You know, you've been around a long time, you've seen a lot. I'm old as water. But you know what? I was touched by these children who got up repeatedly and talked about not just that she was a good teacher, but explained why she was a good teacher, how she instilled confidence in them when they first came here as immigrants and didn't know a lot of people and were a little intimidated. And she pushed them and embraced them and gave them a sense that they could succeed in school. It's very, very touching. I'm not talking about one or two kids now. We're talking like 10 kids spoke at the last school board meeting in Berkeley. So as a teacher and a political activist, she engages young people by encouraging them to connect their own lives and learning to real-life struggles for social justice. She believes in the capacity of her students and gets the best out of them. All this has made Ms. Furlaka a popular, widely admired teacher in the Berkeley public school system. There is some controversy as usual. I have some black nationalist friends who criticized her because she gets children involved in political activity. Now, this... Yeah, but Rinaldi, here's what... All right, let me just tell you what the nationalists said, and then we can answer that. They say that she's not supposed to get the kids involved without their parents' consent. Now, we're talking now about children, you know, 10, you know, like that. I want to tell you something. I agree with Rinaldi, okay? I think it's a good thing to introduce children to what's going on in the world and to teach them from an early age that what they do matters, that their opinion matters, that they should be involved. That's not a bad thing to me. Okay? On June 26th, as I stated before, 2016, during summer vacation, Ms. Furlaka protested neo-Nazi KKK members who attempted to rally and attack people on the steps of the Capitol of Sacramento. 9 anti-fascist protesters, including Ms. Furlaka, were stabbed by the Nazis. 9. Excuse me. I've been corrected. These same Nazis had already stabbed and almost killed black and Latino protesters in Anaheim earlier this year and had gone to Sacramento to try to do the same thing. The day after the Sacramento rally, violent threats were made by Nazi, racists, and Trump supporters against Ms. Furlaka and against her school if she were not fired. Instead of defending Yvette Furlaka, the Berkeley Unified School District attacked her and began their witch hunt. On June the 30th, 4 days after Ms. Furlaka was stabbed, the district issued her a discipline. Then later, on August the 31st, they took away her entire August paycheck. On Wednesday, September the 21st, the Berkeley Unified School District administration abruptly removed her from her classroom, placing her on administrative leave with no reasons given. I mean, all right, let's not be emotional here. Let's try to be rational, because I'm starting to get mad here, see? So I gotta control myself first so I can get the story out. But the fact that they don't give a reason, it's clear what the reason is. They're capitulating to the fascists who made these threats. Instead of saying, if you harm anybody around or in this school, believe me, you will be dealt with effectively. That's what you would think they would say. Okay. The same day that she was placed on administrative leave, several of Ms. Furlocker's immigrant and English as a second language students reported that they were removed from class and questioned about her without their parents being notified or present. The children were told by the Berkeley Unified School District administration to keep their, quote, interviews a secret and to, quote, tell no one. Ms. Furlocker's attorneys have since filed a cease and desist letter on behalf of the students and their parents against the shameful bullying and interrogations. Yvette Furlocker is a union and civil rights activist. She is a member of the Berkeley Federation of Teachers. That's her union. She's on the executive board of that union, a founding member of the Equal Opportunity Now by Any Means Necessary caucus, and a national organizer with the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action, Integration, and Immigrant Rights, and Fight for Equality by Any Means Necessary. The group is called BAM. Now, I want you all to know something here. I'm not a member of BAM, and I've dealt with them and come into conflict with them sometimes over petty, you know, small differences. I call them petty because when they're melting the earth, when we got people talking about creating a new nuclear arms system in the United States, I can go on. There are much more serious things to worry about than differences of opinions between leftists, okay? But just understand that because they are very aggressive about pushing their line, they have drawn some hostility from radicals and leftists. But for me, the way I look at the world, when the 1% come after a worker, I don't give a goddamn what they did yesterday. Close ranks. An injury to one is an injury to all. We have to support that worker because she's being attacked by the man. Think. Principle over petty subjective considerations or even genuine political differences, because we're going to have differences every day. I don't care what we do, we're going to have differences of opinion. We're not going to agree on everything, and we have to learn to deal with that in a dignified and intelligent fashion and not to turn each other into enemies, because we're not enemies. We're brothers and sisters on the same side of the class line, the 99%, the working class side of that line. I just thought I need to mention that because I know people that don't support her now because they don't like her politics per se. And I think that's a major mistake. Okay? Ms. Furlocker's union is filing a grievance to restore her pay and advocating for her swift return to her classroom. She is taking legal action against the school district for discrimination, violations of free speech, due process, and academic freedom. The outcome of Ms. Yvette Furlocker's struggle is vital to the rights of all teachers and to the struggle against racism and the growth of American fascism. In the context of growing racially violent and far right-wing attacks being waged across the globe and by racism and xenophobia of Mr. Trump's presidential campaign, the decision of the Berkeley Unified School District to discipline and suspend Ms. Furlocker for her off-duty political activities and her political affiliations and activism place Berkeley on the wrong side of the historic struggle to stop the rise of the far right and their violent attacks. So that's going to be all from me right now. I see Zeti is ready, baby. Here we go, team.
I'm just going to give a quick update on a hunger strike that has been going on in Santa Clara County Jail down in San Jose. The hunger strike began on Monday the 17th and ended on Friday the 21st, 5 days into a planned two-week strike. Many of the inmates who participated are pretrial detainees, and there were 300 inmates, roughly, who were estimated to have participated. Around 204 of these inmates were placed in solitary due to their participation in the hunger strike. And 4 days into the strike, nurses at the facility weighed in five inmates who had lost around 40 pounds. So the strike took a very serious toll on inmates' health. And the group made five demands. The hunger strikers made five demands to the sheriff's office, which is responsible for operating and maintaining the county jail, and had a variety of grievances with the facility. The top two requests of the hunger strikers was that, or not was, but is still, is that the sheriff's office adopt the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation's classification system, and in solitary confinement, which is not practiced in state prisons. And the basis for that is that the rules surrounding when an inmate is placed in isolation is vague and based on the administration's opinion. And the inmates who have been on hunger strike are stating that rather than being based on the administration's opinion to throw somebody in solitary, that it should be based on inmates' behavior. The strikers are also calling for more sets of clothing on a day-to-day basis, and the strike is also a boycott against the commissary company. Inmates are claiming that the commissary company is overcharging them for items that have a lower price listed on the product, and that the sheriff's office has been misappropriating the inmate welfare fund, which is designed to benefit in-custody programs. And inmates are stating that they have been charged after they have received the package for basic items that should have been received for free through commissary. And the group is asking, where has this money been going, but hasn't really received a substantive answer. And so those are a few of the grievances that the strikers have been highlighting. And the latest update on the strike was released on Friday, and through the SVDE bug, that hunger strikers have been released from solitary. So once again, there were 204 inmates who participated in the strike who were thrown into solitary. So all of those inmates have been released from solitary and will be able to downclass into general population in 90 days. And even though the hunger strike was suspended on Friday, that doesn't mean that that it's all over. The reason that it ended on Friday is because the hunger strikers have initiated negotiations with the administration and through the sheriff's office, and have stated publicly that the hunger strike will be suspended until lasting changes are met. And you can read the demands for yourself through the SVDE bug Facebook page, which has a list of the demands, a link to the demands. But I'm going to run through them really quickly with you just so you get like a better idea. The first demand is to end meaningless classification review and biased appeal process. And the inmates also developed solutions to each of these grievances. So the first solution is to incorporate classification practices of other jurisdictions, such as the California Department of Corrections and Alameda County. And then a second solution would be to establish independent oversight and review of inmate appeal process, jail conditions, practices, and policies. A third solution to ending meaningless classification review and biased appeal process would be to safeguard all due process protections. The second demand is to end placement and solitary confinement when there exists no serious rule violation to merit such placement. And then prohibit the use of long-term indefinite solitary confinement, as well as prohibit the use of solitary confinement based solely on gang allegations, affiliation, validation. And a few potential solutions to this would be follow the classification and housing practices of other jurisdictions, again, such as the California Department of Corrections, Alameda County. Also, allow all inmates a genuine opportunity to be downclassed and properly integrate into general population. And then a third potential solution would be to classify and house all inmates based on individual behavior. The third demand is to end the policy and practice of denying inmates sufficient clothing. So two solutions to this would be establish policy that promotes proper hygiene and provide two sets of tops and bottoms, three sets of underclothes, and sufficient clothing change. The fourth demand is to end jail profiteering and exploitation of prisoners and their families through contract bidding of commissary vendors based on kickbacks and political incentives for campaign contributions. Two potential solutions for this would be to set commissary prices equal to or cheaper than those set in the California Department of Corrections, and to approve more packaging vendors to create a competitive and fair market. And the last demand, the fifth and final demand, is to end recidivism and misappropriation of inmates' welfare funds. And three potential solutions for ending recidivism and misappropriation of inmates' welfare funds is expand and provide constructive programming and privileges for all inmates regardless of classification status, create opportunities to engage in meaningful self-treatment work, education, and other activities relating to having a sense of being a part of the community in preparation for re-entering society for all inmates, and reallocate inmate welfare funds toward education and rehabilitation programs in Santa Clara County, main jails, north and south. And once again, you can read those demands for yourself if you go to the SVDebug. So just like capital S, capital V, space, D-E, bug, Facebook page, and there is a link to a petition, a change.org petition, that is important because even though the hunger strike was suspended on Friday, these demands have not been completely achieved yet. And even though there has been some indication that things are improving with like more sets of clothing being provided to these inmates, and like, you know, promising to like revise like classification practices and things like that. Ultimately, the public needs to apply pressure on the sheriff's office in order for that to happen. So go sign the petition. It takes a whole like 3 minutes, and you can access that petition and the list of demands through the SVDE Bug Facebook page.
All right. Thank you, Senti. Keep your eye on that story as it develops. One thing we've been tracking the last few weeks regarding the nationwide prison strike is the status of the Holman facility in Alabama. So I wanted to update you on Kinetic Justice, who's been a essential figure in the Free Alabama movement and in the strike activities there. So Holman, as we reported, has gone under federal jurisdiction after having the riot team called in several times to engage the strikers. What's happening now, as of about a week ago, is Kinetic Justice has been transferred to what inmates sort of ominously refer to as the Bully Unit, Kilby Correctional Facility. This is what an anonymous Free Alabama Movement prisoner had to say about the Kilby facility. He says, regarding the transfer, he says, "That's bad. Kilby is our bully camp. That's where inmates go who they deem to be problems that they have to iron out with brutality. You understand what I'm saying? When they send you to Kilby, that's where they break your arms and break your legs." So this is bad news for Free Alabama Movement and for Kinetic Justice. The Free Alabama Movement is unsure whether this is a permanent transfer, whether he will be returned to the Holman facility after the riot teams are finished, or whether he'll be what folks think is a worst case scenario. He may be transferred to a place called Limestone Correctional Facility, where people are kept in up to a year of punitive isolation and solitary confinement. So, if you've been writing to Kinetic Justice, his address has changed, and I encourage you to do that, to sort of help make sure that his spirit isn't broken by this new repression that he's facing.
So. May I just say, I don't believe they're going to break this man's spirit, because he has a record of struggle that I think deserves to be respected by all people that want justice throughout American society. I fear for his well-being, period. Please pay attention to this, because he's been very outspoken. He was on Democracy Now.
Yeah.
On talking to Amy Goodman on the telephone. And you know what? I had a talk with Cole about this. These authorities, they do have egos, and they don't like being made fools of. So, I don't know. I think that may not have been the brightest thing to announce that he was in solitary confinement on a telephone, because that's telling the authorities that they're not in control.
At least not with his name and the name of the facility. Like, if anything, they could have respected his confidentiality, his anonymity, by leaving those details out of the picture, even though he's been such a prominent figure in this struggle. It's not essential to expose him like that, you know, and put him on blast like that. That really just puts him in danger. And ultimately, he's the one who has to deal with the retaliation, not the journalist on the outside.
and here that's what's happening. Like, this is exactly what's going down. So keep an eye out for keep Kinetic Justice in your thoughts. Send him a letter if you can. You can find his new address online through the Free Alabama Movement website, and we'll try to keep you updated on his status as it develops. You know, Cynthia's going to give us an update on something else we've been tracking here on the station.
Early yesterday morning, October 22nd, there was a mass arrest at the DAPL construction site, the Standing Rock, outside of the Standing Rock Reservation. And I'm going to read a brief update on that. Early on Saturday, October 22nd, water protectors from the camps near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation blockaded roads by locking themselves to cars and set out on foot to confront construction that threatens to destroy more sacred burial sites. And there was a independent news channel, Unicorn Riot. There were some journalists with Unicorn Riot who were on site live streaming the coverage and doing documentation on the ground, and who were able to record some of these arrests. But then also there was a Unicorn Riot journalist who was arrested too. And this isn't the first journalist that has been arrested at the Node DAPL construction site. Police have been pretty, like, indiscriminate about who they, like, swoop in and detain. But back to the update, more than 80 people were arrested in relation to Saturday's events. And there is footage of these arrest videos on the Unicorn Riot website if anybody wants to look more into that. But Dakota Access Pipeline construction has continued despite the September 9th request from the federal government to suspend construction within 20 miles east and west of Lake Ohe. And there were some people who were released late last night and early this morning, but out of the 80 people, the 80 water protectors who were arrested, some are still in jail, so stay tuned with that, and check out Unicorn Riot for more updates with how the situation at Standing Rock is developing.
Okay, we're going to take a musical break, and then we're going to be back at you with report backs and about the 50th anniversary celebration of the Black Panther Party.
We will not bow down to racism.
We will not bow down to
injustice.
We will not bow down to
exploitation. I'm gonna stay.
Come and take a walk with me, closer walk with thee, see what only I can see.
Sisters, check this, watch this.
Turn us loose, set us free from all the chains that bind me.
Let us run in our own direction.
Let us go, set us free from all this propaganda and lies.
Set your system embrace you and praise them over God.
All these lies and all this propaganda that you want us to sing.
Okay, we're back. We're back, y'all.
All right. So, something that's been going on in Oakland all weekend is celebrations and conferences, discussions, events regarding the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party. So, we are here with Gerald. We would like to discuss those events with him, as well as that history and its relevance and the lessons that we can still take from this very storied movement. So I haven't been out to the conference, haven't been able to get to the events. Would you like to talk about what you've seen? You said you went to the Polynesian Panthers event and a panel on political prisoners.
Yeah. Okay, I want to start off by just sharing my personal experience, what I did. And, of course, we're looking for everyone else to participate in this discussion. Okay, Wednesday night, I went to the Marcus Garvey Bookstore, which is located on 39th Street and Martin Luther King Boulevard. Martin Luther King Way in Oakland, you know, and there Bobby Seale was signing a new book that he just came out with. You know what, though? Now I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the book, but I looked it over. A beautiful book. It's $40, so I declined to purchase the book at this time. I'll get it. Don't worry about it. I'll eventually. But we had some very, very interesting discussions, Mr. Seale and I know him for a while, and it was just a very interesting evening. Next day, my colleagues from the Oscar Grant Committee and the family of Omar Shakur came and kidnapped me and took me to Merritt College, where there was an event that went from basically 11 to 1 that next day, I think it was Thursday, on the history of the Black Panther Party from a different angle. Because at Merritt College, it was at Merritt College that Bobby Seale met Huey Newton. And they got together and eventually drafted the 10-point program, and the rest is history. But that happened. That started at Merritt College. So this particular event, they had Brother Eddie Conway, who was the historic leader of the Panthers in Baltimore. More on him later. Charlotte O'Neill from Kansas City, who is the wife of Brother O'Neill, who they now live in Tanzania in Africa. More on that. And Albert Woodfox, one of the last of the Angola Three. So let me just go back over these politically persecuted people one at a time so you can kind of get why this was such a valuable treat. Eddie Conway, Marshall Eddie Conway, was the leader of the Black Panthers, became the leader of the Black Panthers in Baltimore. When Eddie was a fireman, he actually worked for, you know, he was one of the first blacks to become a fireman in that city. But when he joined the Panthers, he saw that there was some very strange going-ons, that the people that were running that local were telling the young people that we're going to go out and commit robberies, and that's how we're going to get our monies and stuff. And Eddie thought about this, and he said, no, wait a minute. Is that really the way we want to serve the people? He had his doubts, and he did not think that that was the best way to proceed. He then went and got together with the leadership in New York. They consulted each other. They all agreed that, no, this is not our program. This is not what we're about. It winds up the people that were pushing that were from military intelligence and the NSA. They joined that Panther branch and took it over. Eddie, with the help of people in New York and on other parts of the East Coast, cleaned it up, kicked those guys out of the group, and took over the leadership and began to run that local like the Black Panther local that it should be. Well, needless to say, they hated him for that. Hated him. And eventually what they did was they framed him up for the murder of a police officer that he did not commit, provably. But our judicial system is so crooked, they wouldn't even let Eddie have the lawyer of his choice. That's how you know something's wrong, when they won't let you have the lawyer that you want. That, you know, that's crazy. But he was wrongly convicted, and Eddie served. He just was released. So from 1970, he was in prison. Jessup in Maryland, I visited him there several times. It's a mixture of emotions when you think about this stuff. You know, you get kind of sad, but I'm really glad that he got out in 2014. He was released. So how many years is that? That's 34 years, right? Jesus Christ. No, 44 years, man. 44 years this brother was behind bars for a crime that he did not commit. Framed up. He hit the ground running and is now the executive producer, or one of the executive producers, of the Real News Network. I strongly advise that y'all check it out. Realnews.com. And they do an alternative news service. So very interesting how he followed through. I just want to say this to, you know, for Eddie, because it's hard for people to understand. There are such a things as leaders in this world. And Eddie Conway certainly was, and is, to a certain degree, my leader. The respect that I have for him. And he was the first person to successfully organize a union for prisoners inside the jail. He actually organized SEIU to, you know, come into that that, because back then they had people pressing license plates. It wasn't as rampant as it is today, where they got you working for Victoria's Secret, ATT, Bank of America, an almost endless list that won't be missed when these workers stand up, these incarcerated workers stand up and say no more. You got this shit. You ain't gonna have paying people 25 cents an hour. That's madness. But that is to his credit. That is unique among, you know, all of the prison work that I know of. See, that was a real accomplishment. Okay, now to Charlotte O'Neill. Charlotte O'Neill is the wife of Pete O'Neill. Pete O'Neill got caught up with the gun charge because, as you know, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense physically defended the black community from police abuse in the city of Oakland. The reason that that was possible in the state of California is because it was legal. You know, today they call it open carry. Well, back then, California was open carry state. And using that, you know, Huey Newton was going to law school, so he researched it and he said, hey, shit, if we can open carry, let's do it. And they began to patrol, have armed patrols of the police in Oakland. Now, not every state has identical laws, nor is it, you know, not every Panther had the knowledge of the law or the ability to research the law that Brother Newton did, because he was going to law school. You know, he's a pretty sharp brother. Well, Pete got caught up in a gun charge. And rather than to just go to prison, he escaped the country and wound up in Africa. The Black Panthers had an international section at that time located in Algeria. So Pete got out of the country rather than to go to prison. He wound up gravitating over to Tanzania, and that's where he is today. Obviously, that chicken shit gun charge needs to be dropped. What? Tanzania, right. Did I say it right? Well, it used to be Tanzania years ago. I'm showing my age. But it's Tanzania. I hope I pronounced it right. Thank you, Rinaldi. I got to struggle with that. But the point is, these guys set up a community center in Africa to help the people and the youth in Africa. They took orphans in. They taught kids how to use computers. It's actually pretty honorable. There is a very interesting film about them that you can acquire called A Black Panther in Africa. And you can, you know, see this with your own eyes and make your own evaluation. And lastly, Albert Woodfox, who has recently been released from Angola prison, the last of the Angola Three. This brother, oh man, this brother joined the Black Panthers in prison and carried on the work of the Black Panther Party in prison. Now, I don't know. You know, we were just talking about the Free Alabama Movement, gentlemen. What is his name again, brothers?
Kinetic Justice.
Kinetic Justice and the troubles that he's having, because I'm very leery about these prison authorities. They do not observe their own laws. Anything can happen to you in prison. You can just disappear. There's an interesting program called Trilay or something like that. It's a program about Katrina after the hurricane. And one of the plots is the brother went to prison. They couldn't find him. The prison authorities didn't know where he was. They could not produce the body. So it's dangerous when you have adversaries in the administration of the prison system and you're clearly a political revolutionary. Well, Albert Woodfox stood up to that. I'm sorry, I can't tell you how many years. He said he was in solitary confinement for 44 years. Solitary confinement for 44 years. I think he went in for a robbery, and then a guard was stabbed and killed, and they conveniently placed that on him and Herman Wallace. The authorities framed them up in the prison and gave them life and then put them in solitary confinement. But I want to just show you something about support. Albert said that his brother visited him once a month for every year that he was in prison. I want you to think about that. I'm talking about love. Real love. Not a nonsense. You know, empty rhetoric. Once a month, for over 45 years. That's amazing to me. I respect that. So he just got out this year. It was real good seeing him. Excellent physical condition. Excellent. This man took care of himself. He said he was in a little cell, a little box, 5 feet by 9. But he managed to take very good care of himself. One day, Senti, maybe we'll do some research about the work that he and Wallace did before they were falsely convicted of killing that guard, because they were politically active inside. And they continue, I'm talking about in the general population, and they continue to be active in solitary confinement. I don't know how, don't ask me, because I don't know how. But that was Merritt College. Then that evening I went to Marcus Bookstore once again, Marcus Garvey Bookstore, and they had a program and a new book out about the Polynesian Panthers. So here's something you need to understand. The Black Panther Party did not only exist within the borders of the United States. As I just mentioned, they had an international branch located in Algeria. That was started off by Erwin Cleaver, who was in exile, who left this country and went into exile, and was joined by other Panthers, you know, Cox and O'Neill and many others. But there were other countries where Black Panther branches were set up. Australia, Israel, England. All right, you know what? My memory fails me as to all of them, but I was pleasantly surprised to find out that there was indeed a Polynesian branch of the Black Panthers. And they went on to exist for many, many years. So, because, you know, it's kind of a thing, before you have the internet, the only way you can communicate is to write and stuff. So the real, back in the phone call is $50. You call somebody from Polynesia to the United States, that's $50. So the actual communication is very restricted, if you understand what I'm saying. Okay, now, Friday, I went to the political prisoner panel at the 50th anniversary itself, located at the, they had it at the Oakland Museum, a beautiful location, kind of big, kind of a maze, but that's where they had the different forums and workshops. It was at the Oakland Museum. And this particular, I don't know if you want to call it a workshop, because it was 250 people there, was at the Moore Auditorium. And here at that auditorium, they had, it was Albert Woodfox, it was Eddie Conway, I'm sorry, the third panelist, oh my goodness, has slipped my mind, but it was another political prisoner who had been, another Panther who had been a political prisoner. See, all right, we're not perfect, folks, but we try to the best of our ability to bring the information to you. I forgot to mention this, and that is, Eddie Conway asked me to make an announcement on Wednesday about the case, I think we've talked about it on this program, of Omar Shakur, the young man who was, his house was raided in East Oakland on the 24th of July of this year, with these militarized police in army uniforms, with their flashbang bombs and their grenades and their the snipers and the robot they put in the house, made the children come all outside in their little bedclothes, barefoot. And of course, this was the wrong house, okay? But they have yet to drop the charges for Omar Shakur. So Eddie asked me to make a, a short announcement, which I did, and that was very well received. That was at, you know, that was a Thursday at the Merritt College. Now, at the political prisoner panel at the 50th anniversary at the Oakland Museum, I was asked to make a comment about Mumia Abdul-Jamal, who I am also a member. I'm a busy little bee. I'm also involved with the Labor Action Committee to Free Mumia. And we've had some very high points. And to tell you the truth, right now is not our highest point, but we're struggling to reignite the campaign to free Mumia, because there's a great opening for Mumia right now. And that opening is the following. That opening is a recent Supreme Court decision, Williams versus the state of Pennsylvania, whereby the state has arrived with the Supreme Court rendered the following decision. If you are active in any phase of the prosecution of a citizen to his conviction, you cannot sit in the post-conviction relief on any appellate panel. That makes sense. In other words, how are you going to judge the person twice? Right? So that opening for Mumia is something that we are working on to try to bring Mumia Abdul-Jamal back into the public's memory. Millions of people know about Mumia. Well, remember that name, because we're coming at you now. We need you to tell your friends, your classmates, your co-workers, the people that you worship with at church, anybody, 8 to 80, blind, crippled, or crazy, tell them about Mumia's chance to get out of that goddamn hellhole. So I did that at this political prisoner panel during the discussion period. And then yesterday... Now, you were there yesterday, weren't you? They had a rally yesterday at Oscar Grant Plaza, which is also known as Frank Ogawa Plaza. And I arrived at 10:30. It was an all-day thing. So they had vendors selling, but I saw some nice stuff. I'm getting tired of this Poe stuff. I can tell you something, boy. This... The hell would be in Poe. Whoever told you poverty is good for you lied. It's not good for you. It don't make you feel good. There's nothing good about it. But I saw some beautiful, beautiful things that people had made to support the Panthers. T-shirts, stuff like that. But then this sister made a beautiful, Tracy Bell. She used to be a member of the Oscar Grant Committee, which I'm also active with. And Tracy, she made a picture of Nat Turner on one side, because as you may be aware, there's a movie right now called The Birth of a Nation, which is supposed to be the story of Nat Turner. And on the back, it actually says who Nat Turner is. So, it's not just one little quick statement. It explains when he was born, that he became a preacher, that he went off and killed up about 60 white folks. I'm sorry, but that's what happened. That's what happened. I'm not advocating, you know,
it's okay.
The killing of, no, I'm not advocating, but this is during slavery. This was a slave rebellion in 1831 that actually changed the course of American history, because up until then, these crazy slave-owning bastards was running around telling people that we was happy being slaves. Oh, look, ain't they looking just... I wish that wasn't Dixie. Yeah, fuck that. Well, I'm sorry, excuse me. That is not accurate. Black people were not happy being slaves. So Nat Turner's rebellion made that abundantly clear. And this beautiful T-shirt, you know how much the T-shirt was? How much do you think?
$20.
Yeah, $25. I love, look at Rinaldi's eyes went to the back of his head. Well, look, that's how much it was. And you know what? They sold a bunch of them. It wasn't just that. They had all kinds of beautiful, you know, T-shirts and paraphernalia related to the history of the Black Panther Party. I was, you know, overjoyed and broke. So, you know, I just got to see it and touch it, but I couldn't take nothing home. Okay. But what I did do from 10:30, besides seeing that stuff, is I was out there advocating for Mumia. So I gave out over 500 leaflets about the fact that we're trying to reignite the campaign for his freedom. We have an organizing meeting at the Omni, located 48th Street and Shattuck, 6 o'clock on October the 27th. 4779 Shattuck.
Now it's two sevens.
All right, well, we got a debate going on here. We can look that up. We're going to look that up. But right now, what I would like to do is to share with you one of the more important historical events that occurred in the Black Panther Party. Me being from New York, maybe I'm a little subjective, but I thought that this was really important, that in 1969... the Black Panther Party leadership was raided and they were arrested. And 21 of the best leaders of the Black Panther Party in the New York area were imprisoned, and they attempted to frame us up, to frame up the Panther 21 for plotting to blow up the Botanical Gardens, Macy's, and other public facilities. But the Panthers was never a terrorist. We wasn't trying to hurt the people. We was trying to help the goddamn people. And I tell you something else, the Panthers did not hate white people. We worked with not just white people, but Chinese, Mexican, Puerto Rican, the younger. We helped them to form new groups to organize their communities. So, anyway, this is the story of the Black Panther Party 21 as told by Daruba bin Wahad, slave named Richard Moore, one of the leaders of the Black Panthers in New York.
Black Panther Party. So and you ended up becoming the field secretary?
Yes, field secretary for the New York chapter.
Will okay, and what was your responsibility as a field secretary of the Black Panther?
Field secretary had to deal with working with the organizers for the party and the cadres for the party that were dispersed, that were in a particular general area, and meeting with them, resolving contradictions and stuff like that. Also, I had to do the regular run out to the airport to get the newspaper, which was a primary task of the party, was the distribution of the Panther newspaper. And we had a lot of problems with that because the FBI had a problem, had a program to sabotage the distribution of the newspaper. And so they would misdirect freight, the delivery. They would hold it up at the airport and put it through certain, you know, put us through all these changes just to get the newspaper. So that became a task in and of itself. So I was responsible for dealing with that in the early stages of our organization in New York.
How did you know Fini Shakur during this time?
She first showed up in Harlem and joined the party. She started coming to the political education classes, community classes, and she took her and Lumumba Shakur became friends and comrades, very close friends, and that's how she got the last name Shakur, because she ended up with an African marriage to Lumumba Shakur.
So explain to me the whole Panther 21 situation. They were accusing you guys of trying to bomb three locations, and also they had found like rifles and so forth.
Well, because they couldn't find any material evidence to support a bomb plot, they didn't have any material evidence of that. What they had done is, like I said, you know, they had infiltrated the security section, but you know there were other agents in the Black Panther Party. The agents didn't know each other were agents. You know, they didn't, and so you had a situation in the Panther Party in New York where agents were actually reporting the actions of other agents for another agency as if, you know, this was some individual who was planning something. And of course, the agency is trying to get us to do provocative stuff.